Monitor Monday is recorded before a live online audience. From the studios of Rack Monitor, this is Monitor Monday for April 22nd, 2024. Here's today's rundown. Last week, during a three-day conference, physician advisors gained new insights on how to navigate the treacherous waters of Medicare regulations. Reporting today on that crucial meeting, Dr. Stephanie Van Zandt explains how to protect your facility from audits and takebacks. We will also hear from Phalana Houston, healthcare attorneys Nicole Emanuel and David Glazer, plus Dr. Ronald Hirsch. Now here's the publisher of Rack Monitor and the host of Monitor Monday, Chuck Buck.
As we come on the air this morning, we're monitoring actions of the U.S. Supreme Court. The High Court returns today and is expected to hear oral arguments, including whether a federal healthcare law can preempt state abortion bans. We have a great deal of healthcare news to report, and so we begin this morning, as we usually do, with Dr. Ronald Hirsch. He's making his Monday rounds here on Monitor Monday.
Monday Rounds is sponsored by R1 Physician Advisory Solutions. Here now making his Monday rounds is Dr. Ronald Hirsch.
Well, good morning, all. Last week, as you heard, was the National Physician Advisor Conference. And I want to thank all of those who stopped me and noted how useful they find Monitor Monday for keeping up with the regulatory news. I also hope you enjoyed the conference as much as I did. 3.5 days of informative talks from physician advisors and others around the country, including Talk 10 Tuesday's very own Tiffany Ferguson. Dr. Van Zandt, who you'll be hearing from later, did an amazing job organizing this conference. Let me summarize a couple things I learned. First, Dr. Robert Leviton from New York gave a great talk about his health system's process for peer-to-peers with insurers. He has a great system to collate all the data and track the results and make change. But what really struck me about his talk was when he asked the audience about their familiarity with the documentation changes that came with the evaluation and management update for hospital visits in 2023. And very few in the audience were aware. I didn't believe that. So I asked the same question in my session, and the results were similar. Dr. Leviton and I were shocked. The changes mean no more requirement for documenting a full physical exam that in most cases was never actually done, nor a full review of systems, which in most cases was never actually asked. The visit code is based on documentation of the physician's medical decision-making or time. I just don't get it. The AMA and CMS hand physicians a gift, and the vast majority say no thanks. Now, I want every single one of you to look at your physician notes. If you see a review of systems, I want you to find your medical records physician champion and demand they educate the doctors on the new rules. It's so helpful. Next, as you can imagine, many of the talks at the conference were related to how to deal with Medicare Advantage plans. And one of the best was from Drs. Eddie Hugh and Chris Caulfield from UNC Health. They went into depth about the process for appealing Medicare Advantage denials, which despite my best efforts seems incomprehensible. But Dr. Hugh also went into depth about another way we can influence MA plan behavior, by filing complaints. In the past, I've talked about complaining to your regional CMS office, but Dr. Hugh describes how to do it to actually get action. First, it's important that the complaint not be frivolous. Don't complain because your doctor documented "I expect 2 midnights" on a patient with chest pain, and the MA plan refused to approve inpatient admission. But if you have a solid 2-midnight inpatient case, an inpatient-only surgery, they won't allow inpatient admission, or so on, and the MA plan medical director states the 2-midnight provisions don't apply to them, or you have a pediatrician denying a patient access to inpatient rehabilitation services when the patient truly meets the requirements, then a complaint is warranted. Now, Dr. Hugh recommends sending the complaint to the CMS regional office, but most importantly, requesting that they acknowledge receiving the complaint by sending you the complaint tracking module ID number that was assigned to the case. It's important also to send the complaint to the CMS regional office in 2 emails. The first with a password protected document with the clinical information and the violation that you're claiming, right? Don't send medical records. CMS does not want a ream of paper. They don't want a huge pile of electrons, just a summary. Right? The second email, of course, should be just the password for that document. Now, CMS cannot open emails that are encrypted by your email system, so you must use this two-email system. Ask your IT department for help so that you do it compliantly. Now, why would you take the time to file these complaints? Well, CMS tracks formal complaints, and a lot of complaints can significantly affect the MA plan's quality bonus. And we know how when there's money at stake, the MA plans suddenly pay attention. Want to know how scared they are of complaints? I got an email from Chrissy who told me that she told an MA plan that she was going to be filing a complaint with CMS. The MA plan told her, if you disagree with us, there's no need to file a complaint with CMS. CMS can't do anything but forward the concern to us. All you need to do is file the appeal with us. Yep, they really don't like complaints. So get out there and start lodging complaints. Now, be sure to read my article in RAC Monitor this week, and I'll have a lot more details on the proper way to do this. Thanks, Chuck. Back to you.
Thank you, Dr. Hirsch. That was the Vice President of R1 RCM, Ronald Hirsch, MD. Dr. Hirsch was making his Monday rounds here on Monitor Monday. Here now with the Monitor Money RAC Report is healthcare attorney Nicole Emanuel. Good morning, Nicole.
Hello, and happy RAC Monitor Monday. It has been nearly 40 years since the Supreme Court indicated in Chevron versus National Resources Defense Council that courts should defer to an agency's reasonable interpretation of an ambiguous statute. Earlier this year, the Supreme Court heard arguments about possibly abolishing the Chevron deference rule. Is that good or bad? Well, let's hash it out. Regardless of your opinion after hearing multiple podcasts here on RAC Monitor, the Supreme Court will decide the Chevron deference rule's legality this summer. And listening to the oral arguments earlier this year, it seems like a majority of the justices seemed ready to jettison the doctrine, or at least significantly limit it. This is a critical aspect of administrative law that often remains in the shadows of legal discourse, but holds immense implications for the functioning of our government. The rule, born out of the Supreme Court case in 1984, has been a cornerstone of administrative law, dictating how courts should defer to federal agencies' interpretations of ambiguous statutes. But as with any legal document, it invites debate, scrutiny, and calls for reform. In simple terms, the Chevron deference rule mandates that if a statute is ambiguous, courts should defer to the reasonable interpretation of that statute made by the agency tasked with implementing it, unless that interpretation is unreasonable. In essence, it grants federal agencies significant leeway in interpreting laws passed by Congress. This deference has profound effects on the balance of power between the branches of government. For example, CMS is an agency that is allowed deference in its rules that it makes that are not laws. See the importance? Without the Chevron deference rule, ALJs would not be bound by CMS's rules that are not laws. For example, CMS is of the mindset that extrapolation is perfectly legal, allowed, and upheld by everyone, and the ALJs are bound to agree. No Chevron deference rule, the ALJs become independent. The rationale behind the Chevron deference rule is to recognize the experience of administrative agencies in their respective fields. These agencies possess specialized knowledge and experience that enable them to navigate complex regulatory landscapes. By allowing them deference in interpreting ambiguous statutes, the rule seeks to promote consistency, efficiency, and expertise. But does it? However, as with every legal doctrine, the Chevron deference rule is not without its critics. Some argue that it unduly concentrates power in the hands of unelected bureaucrats, diminishing the role of the judiciary in interpreting the law. Moreover, it raises concerns about accountability and democratic legitimacy as it could shield agency actions from robust judicial review. The Chevron rule has also become subject of political contention, particularly in recent years, and we shall find out what happens this summer. Back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Nicole, very much. That was healthcare attorney Nicole Amanda. Nicole is a partner of the law firm of Nelson Mullins. And coming up at about 10 minutes after the hour in your time zone, you're going to hear from healthcare attorney David Glazer and Dr. Stephanie Van Zandt. She's standing by to report our lead story.
Are you looking for a better way to manage risk assessments? Are you familiar with CERT, C-E-R-T? CERT is the Comprehensive Error Rate Testing Program. You can leverage the CERT to create your own internal coding and billing risk assessment plan. And RAC Monitor's senior healthcare consultant Frank Cohen will show you how to leverage the Comprehensive Error Rate Testing Program to create your own internal coding and billing risk assessment plan. The webcast, Leveraging the CERT, a new coding and billing risk assessment plan with Frank Cohen, is now available on demand. Listen and learn at the RAC University Bookstore.
Here now with the Monitor Monday Risky Business Report is healthcare attorney David Glazer. And David, as I say every Monday morning about the same time, what could be risky this morning?
Well, Chuck, every Monday I tell you something that could be risky, but not today. Today I'm going the opposite direction because I have to start with a huge thank you. So before I get to my segment, my friend and colleague, Sam Orbovich, who hangs out on the other side of this wall, was in a car accident on Thursday. And I just put a link in the chat box. You may have seen it because it's gone national. His car caught fire and a half dozen Good Samaritans risked their life to save him. So that's all I will say about this, other than our firm is figuring out the right way to thank those people. But for if you think people aren't good, watch this video. It'll change your mind. So onto the substance. I'd say it's failing to understand what remuneration is. Now, I don't mean remuneration, which is when a cow has acid reflux, or remuneration, which is when you give multiple Medicare outpatient observation notices. Instead, I'm talking about the confusing terms that both Medicare, the Medicare anti-kickback statute, and the Stark Law use to describe something of value. The physician anti-referral law, or usually called Stark, defines remuneration as anything that includes directly or indirectly, overtly or covertly, in cash or in kind. The anti-kickback statute doesn't even define it that clearly. So if you want to understand whether or not a kickback is occurring, you need to know, for example, what if a hospital improves the turnaround time in its OR? This allows surgeons to do more surgeries. Is that remuneration? What if a nursing home replaces a crummy EHR, electronic health record, with a new one, and that greatly facilitates the services of a visiting physician? What if a physician group has current issues of magazines in the waiting room rather than the 1965 issue of Highlights? Is that remuneration? Well, while there's not been an absolutely 100% definitive answer to the question, a case from last year from the Federal Court of Appeals offers some extremely helpful language. So the case, Martin versus Hathaway, arose out of a dispute from Oaklawn Hospital in Michigan. A physician asserted that the hospital was improperly compensating or providing remuneration to another physician. The Court of Appeals rejected that argument, concluding that the law must be referring to money or something similar to money. As the court explained, and this is a quote, "Here is one other problem with the broader definition. It lacks a coherent endpoint. Consider the hospital that opens a new research center, purchases top-of-the-line surgery equipment, or makes a donation to charities in the hopes of attracting new doctors. Or consider the general practitioner who refuses to send patients for kidney dialysis treatment at a local healthcare facility until it obtains more state-of-the-art equipment. Are these all forms of remuneration? Unlikely at each turn." That's the end of the quote. So this means that most actions that improve the delivery of care without an exchange of cash or a cash equivalent are arguably permissible. Of course, one can take that too far. I will close with two examples that may seem similar, but one has received a favorable advisory opinion, and the other resulted in a false claims settlement of millions of dollars. So let's say a hospital wants to provide a nurse practitioner to round on patients. The nurse practitioner is going to serve as the first call for help, reducing the number of calls that the attending physician takes. Is this kosher? Well, according to the advisory opinion, as long as the service is provided to all patients, regardless of the number of referrals from the attending physician, and there's either no bill for the service or the hospital is the party billing, it's fine. But if the hospital is choosing specific physicians for this service and permitting those physicians to bill for the hospital employees, the answer is quite different, as a hospital in Detroit learned as it paid two settlements on this issue. As soon as the physician starts to bill, the hospital is now providing something akin to a cash equivalent. Chuck, since I'm only 5'9", and I was the shortest kid in class until third grade, I've always had a bit of a bone to pick with Randy Newman of Short People Got No Reason fame. But he correctly captured the thoughts of the Sixth Circuit when he sang, "It's money that matters. Hear what I say. It's money that matters. In the USA." It's the money that matters. Hear what I say. It's the money that matters in the USA. Back to you, Monsieur Buck.
Thanks, David, very much. That was healthcare attorney David Glazer. David is a shareholder in the law firm of Frederickson Byron in downtown Minneapolis. It's money that matters. Now you know that it's true. It's money that matters. Whatever you do. Up next, Philana Houston with a Monitor Monday Legislative Update.
The Legislative Update is sponsored by Zealous. Zealous is modernizing the healthcare financial experience by bridging the gaps and aligning interests across payers, providers, and healthcare consumers.
Here now is Philana Houston. Good morning.
Good morning, Chuck. I'm going to touch on a number of healthcare news stories we're seeing at the federal level. Taking lessons learned from the COVID pandemic, the Biden administration unveiled the strategy the U.S. has planned to prevent and, if necessary, respond to global biological threats over the next 5 years. The strategy sets out three goals to guide the United States' affirmative agenda to advance global health security. The first goal is to strengthen global partnerships. To achieve this first goal, the U.S. has reportedly expanded its formal global health security partnerships from 19 countries to 50 countries. The second goal of the plan is to commit to achieving health security, which includes transforming financing for global health security. And the third goal is to improve links between different health security programs. This includes better integration of global health programs and better integration with other programs such as humanitarian and disaster response, food security, water sanitation, and hygiene. The hope is that by meeting the goals of this strategy, the world will be better prepared for the next pandemic. In other news, a recent blog post from the American Hospital Association critiqued the national discussion on healthcare price transparency. The blog argues that although hospitals report more transparency data than other healthcare entities, calling upon hospitals to release even more data will not solve the pressing issues that face the healthcare industry. The blog post argued that existing hospital reporting is extremely costly, time-consuming, and ever-changing, and that commercial insurers and drug companies are not held to the same data reporting standards. In other news, HHS Secretary Xavier Becerra spoke at a Senate hearing and urged states to expand Medicaid to improve rural health outcomes. Becerra stated HHS is doing what it can so women get good care before delivery, good care during delivery, and good care after delivery. Becerra also emphasized the need to ensure the agency's COVID-19 telehealth flexibilities continue. Relatedly, Mississippi Senator Cindy Hyde-Smith also expressed concerns about maternal care deserts caused by hospital closures in her state at the same Senate hearing last week. Senator Smith noted Mississippi experiences some of the worst maternal health outcomes in the country and often leads the country in infant mortality. Finally, a recently published study in Health Affairs Scholar reports telehealth remains underused and remote patient care is either rarely billed to Medicare or rarely occur. For example, in 2020, e-visits accounted for just under 1% of all managed service codes submitted to Medicare at the height of the pandemic, which later fell to 0.5% in 2021 and 2022. The study reports that overall, telehealth remains underutilized and claims its findings can help alleviate concerns regarding potential overuse of portal message and e-visit billing. Back to you, Chuck.
Thank you, Philana. That was Philana Houston. Philana is the Assistant General Counsel for Zealous.
Maintaining strict regulatory compliance continues to be a challenge. A variety of factors, including a deluge of regulatory news, make it feel like you're navigating turbulent waters. Now more than ever, you need to be sure everyone on your team, including those who work remotely, is following the same guidance and moving in the same direction. A subscription to Rack Monitor Compliance Webcast is your port in the storm. For a single money-saving fee, your entire team can access the full library of exclusive Rack Monitor educational webcasts featuring nationally acclaimed compliance and audit experts. Register at the Rack University Bookstore today.
As you heard us mention at the top of the broadcast, many of the nation's leading physician advisors met here last week in San Diego. And what they learned about navigating treacherous waters of Medicare regulations was, in a word, troubling. Here now to report our lead story is Dr. Stephanie Van Zandt, and she was had a front row seat, actually, to this very crucially important meeting.
Good morning, Chuck. And good morning, Monitor Monday audience. As announced, I'm Dr. Stephanie Van Zandt, and I have the honor of being one of the co-chairs to the National Physician Advisors Conference in beautiful Coronado, California. We're from April 14th to the 18th, NPAC, as we so lovingly call it. 2024 unfolded as a breathtaking spectacle of innovation insight. Thanks to Dr. Hirsch for the shout out at the beginning of the podcast here. And as you're aware, it takes a village. So thanks to the NPAC, my NPAC co-chair, Dr. Scott Cooley, as well as the NPAC chair, Dr. Liz Quinn, and conference organizer, Tracy Mitchell. The conference themed Physician Advisors on Duty, Safeguarding Patients Amidst the Shifting Currents of Healthcare. I know that's a mouthful, but it was supposed to envision San Diego, you know, out there in Coronado. It covered a vast spectrum of topics, including professional development, evolving roles, all the way to CDI and physician advisors in the pediatric realm. At NPAC 2024, the attendees witnessed the convergence of cutting-edge technology to optimize healthcare. One of the standout features was the addition of EHR and analytics category, which showcased pioneering AI solutions for CDI and utilization management, promising to revolutionize healthcare from many fronts. Moreover, the timeless appeal of events such as Observation Quiz Bowl and Leadership Panel continue to engage both seasoned professionals and newcomers alike, fostering an atmosphere of collaboration and growth. Several of the main stage and track presentations at NPAC 2024 were dedicated to regulatory discussions, featuring lead industry features like NPAC's keynote speaker, Mr. Mark Hartstein. Mr. Hartstein, renowned for his pivotal role in the development of the Two-Midnight Rule during his time at CMS, led discussions on all sorts of Medicare issues. One intriguing question addressed was the role of social determinants of health in determining inpatient status underneath the Two-Midnight Rule. According to the regulation 42 CFR 412.3, social determinants of health can indeed be considered provided appropriate documentation supports their impact on patient outcomes. Another highlight was NPAC newcomer Rochelle Marting's presentation on Medicare Advantage regulatory changes and effects on physician advisor, and impact on CDI. As a healthcare attorney specializing in managed care and reimbursement matters, Martin shed light on compliance with general coverage and benefit conditions in the CMS 4201F rule. Interpreting the dicey language surrounding appropriate internal coverage criteria for inpatient status determination, Ms. Martin provided ammunition to help avoid MA plan denials and pitfalls in the application of internal coverage criteria. Specifically, she pointed out that technically the MA plans could use the internal coverage criteria when there were not fully established cover criteria for an item or service, but the criteria must be publicly accessible, and the MA plans have the burden to demonstrate that the internal criteria have clinical benefits to the patient that are highly likely to outweigh clinical harm. Ms. Martin also drove home that MA plans may not use interval or MCG criteria or similar products to change covered or payment criteria already established underneath the traditional Medicare. She argued it just like a true lawyer. Dr. Hirsch also took the stage to provide an update on 2024 regulatory landscape, discussing key provisions such as the CMS 4201F and the proposed rule 4204P regarding condition code 44 and the loss of inpatient appeal rights. I just want to say that NPAC 2024 is not just a conference. It's a testament to the dedication of physician advisors from across the country gathering together to share information while safeguarding patient care amidst the shifting currents in our current health care landscape. Please join us next year in Chicago for NPAC in early April 2025. Thank you for joining me as we explored the regulatory highlights of NPAC 2024. And back to you, Chuck.
Thank you, Dr. Van Zandt. That was Dr. Stephanie Van Zandt who reported our lead story. And folks, that is going to be a wrap for this live edition of Monitor Monday. We thank you so very much for being with us today. And a special thank you to our panelists today, Nicole Emanuel, David Glazer, Dr. Ronald Hirsch, and Dr. Stephanie Van Zandt who reported our lead story. And one more thing before we go, please join me tomorrow on Talk 10 Tuesday. That's where we're going to learn about how to conquer sleep deprivation. Until tomorrow, I'm Chuck Buck reporting for Rack Monitor and Monitor Monday. Have a great week, everybody.
Monitor Monday is a presentation of Rack Monitor.